Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Pastor Doug Padgett, Executive Director of the Minneapolis-based group Vote Common Good, who considers how Minnesota is showing America how to courageously and effectively resist Trump ICE violence. Fairfax County, Virginia attorney Steve Descano, who discusses the mission of the new group, Fight Against Federal Overreach, a coalition of local prosecutors working to hold federal lawbreakers accountable for their crimes. And Sylvia Baldwin, a member of the Starbucks Workers United Union, a bargaining delegate and a strike captain, who talks about poor working conditions and low pay at the coffee giant stores that led to the ongoing three-month-long strike. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In mid-January, Syria's new government's army overran territories controlled by the Kurdish Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, the same militia that had years earlier defeated the ISIS insurgency in northeast Syria. Government forces quickly recaptured nearly two-thirds of SDF territory. But according to the Christian Science Monitor, what was striking was not just a change in the balance of power on the ground in Syria, but a dramatic shift in Washington. For years, the U.S. relied on the SDF to combat the Islamic State terrorist movement and guard thousands of ISIS prisoners. But the Trump administration has now turned its back on the Kurdish force, pivoting to support the government in Damascus under rebel-turned-president Ahmed al-Sharaa. Under a late January ceasefire agreement, Damascus gave Kurdish forces a short deadline to finalize a pact to integrate its army and civilian institutions into the Syrian state. After the fall of dictator Bashar al-Assad in December 2024, a conflict emerged between the Kurds and the new government over the future shape of Syria. While the Kurdish SDF wanted greater autonomy, al-Sharaa's government has now taken military action to impose a unified central state, which has the support of the Trump regime. A recent court ruling has cleared the way for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to resume using states' Medicaid data to locate undocumented immigrants residing in the country. Although a ruling in the case is not final, immigrants, including those who adhere to procedures for applying for asylum, will have to weigh the benefits of gaining health coverage against the risk that enrolling in Medicaid could make them or their family members easier for ICE to find. Last summer, 22 states and the District of Columbia sued the Trump administration to block Medicaid from sharing information with ICE on the program's primarily low-income enrollees. But in late December, a federal judge ruled that ICE can use some basic Medicaid data in its deportation proceedings, including addresses, phone numbers, birth dates, and citizenship or immigration status, although the law prohibits federal Medicaid funds from covering undocumented immigrants. Nearly half of states, including some controlled by Republicans, use their own Medicaid money to provide health coverage for children and pregnant women, regardless of immigration status. Immigrant rights advocates now worry that ICE's use of Medicaid data will keep many immigrant families from seeking the health care that states have said they're eligible to receive. 2 years ago, the Michigan Democratic primary for the state's U.S. Senate seat was easily won by the party establishment's endorsed candidate, Alyssa Slotkin, who went on to defeat a Trump-backed candidate in November. But in 2026, the campaign for the August 4th Democratic primary's open Senate seat is heating up. The candidates facing off are Congresswoman Haley Stevens, a favorite of the party establishment, center-left state senator Mallory McMorrow, and former Detroit Health Director Abdul El-Sayed, backed by Senator Bernie Sanders and the state's progressive activists. Although Representative Stevens has name recognition, her refusal to condemn Israel's Gaza genocide and her acceptance of campaign funds from the Israel lobby group AIPAC could present a problem in a state with the highest concentrated population of Arab Americans in the country. Political observers expect Gaza to be a swing issue, where El-Sayed and the progressives can take the offensive against Stevens and McMorrow, whose record on the slaughter of Palestinian civilians in Gaza has been at times equivocal and cautious. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
A growing number of Americans who are witnessing the lethal brutality of Donald Trump's ICE secret police force across the country believe the people of Minnesota are a critical line of defense against an authoritarian federal government determined to destroy the rule of law and democracy. After ICE agents killed Renee Good and Alex Pretty, a third shooting, dozens of incidents where citizens and non-citizens were violently attacked without provocation, the arrest of peaceful ICE observers, and the abduction of a 5-year-old boy, tens of thousands of people in Minnesota have demonstrated extraordinary courage and resilience by putting their freedom and very lives on the line, resisting tyranny in the streets of their own neighborhoods. On two consecutive Fridays, January 23rd and 30th, large numbers of Minnesotans from all walks of life participated in a general strike and work stoppage under the banner of ICE out of Minnesota. At the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport, local police arrested about 100 faith leaders on January 23rd, demonstrating against ICE violence, while dozens of cities across the U.S. have organized Minnesota solidarity protests in recent weeks. While the harsh rhetoric from the Trump White House may have changed slightly, the reality of repression on the ground in Minnesota hasn't. Your reporter spoke with Pastor Doug Padgett, executive director of the Minneapolis-based group Vote Common Good. Here he talks about the brave determination of people in his state standing up to Trump regime violence and his advice to people across the country on how best to prepare for similar assaults on their communities.
This Trump administration has no plans to stop only in this city. They want to punish political enemies all over the country by sending what seems to function as something akin to Donald Trump's personal military force through ICE into American cities to destabilize and to terrorize and to make it impossible for people to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And it's the most un-American presidency we could have ever imagined. It's rogue and it's dangerous. And Minneapolis and the larger Twin Cities area, and then also outstate Minnesota, has really suffered greatly, because when you put our immigrant populations into a point of fear, that damages our society. People from all over the world make Minneapolis, make Minnesota a thriving, beautiful place to live, and our freedoms are connected to those people. And when they can't leave their houses, when they are terrorized by the presence of ICE, it makes it harder on all of us. And if you think that the Trump administration is going after only people who should not be in the country, or the worst of the worst, or all the other propaganda nonsense that this administration continues to say and so many people continue to parrot, then you might think, well, maybe it's reasonable that, you know, extreme measures need to be taken. But the thing we know to be true is they are not going after the worst of the worst. They are not only detaining and arresting people who are in this country without legal authorization and certification to be in the country, but the great majority of people they've taken into custody are either citizens or people born in the state of Minnesota. My own son, who's adopted into our family with two adopted children, is of Mexican heritage, but was born here in Minnesota, in Minneapolis. And he drives for Amazon. And his dispatcher said to a whole number of the people that were there, any of you that look like you all look, we advise that you carry your birth certificate and your passport. So my adult son had to come to our house to pick up his birth certificate and passport that he keeps here at our house so that he could go to work in the city of Minneapolis. The idea that Minneapolis-born American citizens have to carry papers to answer to a bunch of masked, unqualified, money-seeking government troops is absolutely unthinkable. And yet, that's what we're experiencing in this city.
And Pastor Padgett, I wanted to ask you this. After the death of Renee Good on January 7th and Alex Preddy on January 24th, what's the mood of the people you talk to about their anger, their fear, frustration, and worry about the state of the city, state of the state, as well as the state of the entire country here that they are really on the front lines of?
None of us are concerned about going to protests because those are big and they're organized and they're peaceful. It's walking down the regular street in Minneapolis and thinking I could be in a confrontation with a federal agent at any moment. That is what makes people scared, and that is what makes people angry, and that is what makes the people of this city resilient so that people are out there whenever we can be, just driving around, walking around, looking around, trying to make sure we can make this city safe for those in this community that could be gathered up. Like poor little Liam, that poor little six-year-old boy, swept up and sent off to Texas. These people are so senseless. They took a child and his father and shipped him to a detention center in Texas. So that's who we're trying to protect. People who have every right to be here, people who live in our communities and make it up, and we have to keep them from being accosted and abducted by the federal government.
If you were to pick any lesson out that people in Minnesota and Minneapolis have learned over this last couple of months of this ICE surge of agents and the brutality and the killing that's gone on, for the rest of the nation, what's the lesson you would impart?
I would strongly encourage people, wherever you are, anything you can do to build connection, neighborhood connection, community connection, connections with law enforcement, which for a lot of us has been a really hard thing because our law enforcement in Minneapolis has been on the wrong side of goodness for far too long, but still building that, because right now this police in the city of Minneapolis and the state troopers and the National Guard are helping to protect American citizens from the federal government. So from local neighborhoods, faith communities, whatever you can do to build social cohesion, it's going to pay off in the end. So any way you can connect with your citizens and not feel at odds with them, find a way to do it. Right. Because when the Trumpy people come knocking at our doors, they are going to have no care or concern for anything else that we hold to other than our ability to hold one another's hands.
That was Pastor Doug Padgett, Executive Director of the Minneapolis-based group Vote Common Good. Find more analysis and commentary on the brutal federal assault on Minnesota and people's organized resistance by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After ICE agent Jonathan Ross shot and killed 37-year-old Minneapolis mother of three, Renee Good, on January 7th, Vice President J.D. Vance and other Trump regime officials stated that Ross and all ICE agents are protected by absolute immunity from prosecution. But according to legal experts and constitutional scholars, this claim is false. In fact, ICE and Customs and Border Protection agents who engage in violent, illegal conduct on the job can face state criminal penalties, including prison time. While the Department of Homeland Security has said there will be no investigation into Renee Good's death and have blocked the sharing of evidence with Minnesota prosecutors, Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty is considering filing state charges against ICE agent Ross. After CBP agents killed Minneapolis ICU nurse Alex Preddy on January 24th, the Department of Justice said its Civil Rights Division will be investigating the shooting. But just as in the Good case, The Trump administration has refused to cooperate with local officials. In late January, a new national coalition of locally elected prosecutors announced the formation of a new group called Fight Against Federal Overreach, an initiative to hold federal officials accountable when they break state laws, especially in states around the country where ICE and CBP agents are being deployed. Your reporter spoke with Fairfax County, Virginia Commonwealth's attorney Steve Descano, a co-founder of the new group, who talks about its mission amid growing concerns about warrantless entries, unlawful detentions, and violent tactics employed in its raids and other local operations.
The mission of the organization, which as you mentioned, is a collection of elected prosecutors from around the country, is we believe that we're protecting the rule of law. I think everybody in our organization was sickened and appalled by what happened to Alex Pretty and Renee Good. And I think that we all came together recognizing that if we don't stand up for the rule of law, we're going to lose this country. So really what we have is a bunch of prosecutors who are taking the brave stand to let these federal agents know, regardless of what the president, what Stephen Miller, what anybody told you, you don't have federal immunity or you don't have full immunity. And if you come into our jurisdictions and you commit state crimes, we're going to do everything that we can to make you answer for state authorities. Because at the end of the day, if we can't uphold the Constitution, we're in really, really bad shape in this country. And that's, you know, kind of what we're trying to do here.
Attorney Descano, what are some examples or scenarios of instances where a federal officer, official, or a federal agent, like someone from ICE or CBP, what's an example of something that you believe would be appropriate as a state prosecutor to get involved in and prosecute?
Well, to be quite honest with you, I think you look at it through the lens of how you would evaluate a case involving a local officer. We are talking about any violation of somebody's constitutional rights. We are talking about when there is violence inflicted on individuals unreasonably from law enforcement. I mean, let's call it what it is. We're seeing these videos out of Minneapolis. We're seeing them from other places with these agents beating people on the street, shooting and killing people on the street, essentially abducting people. It's complete lawlessness. It's chaos out there. I know my experience when I brought charges against federal officers in state court was very, very similar to the Renee Good incident. You know, somebody trying to drive away and an officer shooting at a moving car. So these are the things that we're worried about. You know, at the end of the day, Scott, what I believe we are seeing is we are seeing chaos on the streets that is being fueled by the upper reaches of our government telling these guys, you don't have anything to worry about. You'll get away with it. Well, we're here to tell you, you're not going to get away with it. If you screw around in the state, you're going to have to answer to state authorities. And I want them to know that there's no federal pardon power that's going to get these guys out from that jam. It's a tricky road to hoe, but it can be walked, and that's what we're committed to doing.
Just from the point of view of a local prosecutor like yourself, what are your concerns going into the 2026 election? There's a lot of people out there who are thinking Donald Trump will do everything possible. He'll cross all kinds of lines to prevent Congress from falling into the hands of Democrats, who he fears will invoke an impeachment resolution against him. We've seen him do it before. In 2021, January 6th at the Capitol, with the insurrection, the violent mob that attacked the Capitol to prevent the peaceful transfer of power when Donald Trump lost that election. What are you worried about in 2026, not that many months from now?
It's not that many months from now. And I'll tell you, I was thinking about this earlier today. I'm worried about them trying to take control. I saw Trump mention nationalizing elections, which is a clear violation of the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. I think they're trying to weaken our institutions. And I think the thing that really keeps me up at night is Election Day. I worry about armed federal agents at polling places under the pretext of immigration or this or that, scaring people away from coming out to exercise the franchise, scaring people who are more likely to be Democratic voters away because of their skin color or the way they speak or where they're from. I really do think all of this is intertwined. And the thing that keeps me up at night is that not only will we not have free and fair elections, but that on actual election day, there will be armed federal agents trying to ensure Donald Trump wins and that there will be violence in the streets. And By the way, when we talk about fighting against federal overreach, that's some of what we're talking about as well, right? We're talking about our elections, but also, you know, election integrity. Those are the types of cases that we as prosecutors handle as well. So trust me, we're not just thinking about what's happening in Minneapolis today. We're thinking about what's happening in the polling place 7 months from now.
That was Fairfax County, Virginia Commonwealth's attorney, Steve Descano, a co-founder of the new group called Fight Against Federal Overreach. Learn more about the group and participating local prosecutors by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since November 13th last year, 12,000 Starbucks workers from 670 stores out of 17,000 in the U.S. have been on strike in an effort to pressure the company to return to the bargaining table. Since the first Starbucks Workers United Union local was organized at a store in Buffalo, New York in December 2021, the union has grown and is still adding new stores weekly. The union's demands include increasing staffing levels, as too few workers at stores leads to longer wait times for customers, higher take-home pay to provide all workers a living wage, and resolution of hundreds of outstanding unfair labor practice charges for company union busting. The union says Starbucks has committed more labor law violations than any employer in modern history. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Sylvia Baldwin, a barista who's worked at a Starbucks store on the University of Pennsylvania campus in West Philadelphia for the past 3.5 years. She's an elected bargaining delegate and a strike captain. Here she explains her decision to work at Starbucks and then go out on strike and what the union is demanding.
Yeah, I got a job at Starbucks in 2022. I had heard that it was, as far as retail goes, a pretty like stable job with good hours, good benefits, that it was a good environment for like queer people. And I just desperately needed the job. When I was hired, I learned in the interview, after I had already been offered the position and accepted and been hired at the location, the manager told me that it was a union store. And I don't think I did a very good job containing my glee. And I didn't know a lot about the campaign and why workers were organizing besides why any worker would organize, you know, for better conditions. You know, it became very clear very quickly why Starbucks workers were choosing to create and join a union, because the situation in the stores was just a disaster. Like, understaffing was systemic. Workers didn't have a say in the operations at all, and management was negligent, and workers were not able to access the benefits that were so, you know, touted by the company. And in fact, more than half the workers at the store when I was hired had been forced out after the initial like election period. After they fought for and won their election, there was like less than half of the staff left over, people who had been fired illegally or constructively dismissed by having their conditions worsened so much that they just had to quit themselves.
It sounds like there's just been stonewalling the whole time. Has there been any like good faith bargaining at all?
Workers at this company, like I was saying, organized around issues like pay, staffing, scheduling, more hours, and also like health and safety issues, dignity, discrimination, job stability. And those are still the main issues for most Starbucks workers. And we ran a very successful pressure campaign for years and did successfully bring the company to the table in early 2024. After years of stonewalling and union busting, becoming the most unprecedented violator of labor law in contemporary history, they did start bargaining with us. And we bargained in good faith for about 9 months. And we made a lot of progress on all of the, what we call the non-economic issues. So all those things like health and safety, democratic participation, mechanisms for holding the company accountable, enforcing the contract, non-discrimination. Those things we have made a lot of progress on. The company, though, did start stonewalling again after many months of good faith bargaining around those economic issues like pay and staffing, which is when bargaining broke down. They made it very clear that they were uninterested in moving at all towards our position and unwilling to put any money into the contract. That's when we started building towards this strike that is in many cities in the country still ongoing, the longest unfair labor practice strike, the longest work stoppage in the history of the company.
One article I read said that the company was claiming that workers were being paid $30 an hour.
Yes, that's one of their talking points, and it's false. They are fudging the numbers and arriving at this $30 an hour average salary figure by trying to factor in total benefits package, the total amount of benefits that a worker could access. But the truth of the matter is that we know that the average Starbucks worker is actually scheduled below cutoff for those benefits.
Are all the stores that are on strike, do they have operating picket lines?
We are tactical with our picket lines. We picket at all of the stores at some point, but we consolidate on different days. We try to keep it sort of unpredictable for the company to make it difficult for them to respond.
Does your union, since it's new, relatively new, do you get strike benefits?
Yeah, we're very lucky. I mean, our union actually, Starbucks Workers United is new as of 4 years ago, but Workers United shares a direct lineage to the lady garment workers. So our union is actually quite old. There are a lot of workers in our union who are not Starbucks workers, who with their dues dollars and with the officials that the representatives that they elect through their democratic processes continue to choose to support our campaign because they know that if Starbucks workers have it better, that everybody has it better, that if we build power, that they build power too.
That was Sylvia Baldwin, a member of the Starbucks Workers United Union. Learn more about the Starbucks Workers Strike by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Boston, Massachusetts, WTUL in New Orleans, Louisiana, KGBC in Chickaloon, Alaska, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.